Awesome 2 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 312, Mormonism and its Two Ultimates, a paper presented by James McLaughlin, with a response by Benjamin Huff.
And he's just a wonderful person. We've done a couple of sessions together where we've chatted on process theology, and he's just a great contributor to Sunstone for a long, long time. He is the author of a book, The Desire to be God, Freedom and the Other, in Sartre and Berdyaev. Because Sartre, you know, Sartre, and you know, all that stuff, and you never had to say that, and then Berdyaev I've heard a million times too. And his interests besides them are in personalism, existentialism, and idealism. As I mentioned, he's married to Carrie Ann McLaughlin. They have three children, and it's always a pleasure. And I think you're going to just get a clue. Every time you come to a session with Jim, he's so animated, you can just tell what a great teacher he is. And we got the chalkboard here, and I imagine it'll just be a fun, free-flowing thing. He's just an enthusiastic instructor, and I really enjoy him. Now, we're very pleased to have Benjamin Huff, Ben, as our respondent. Ben, again, a frequent and valued contributor to Sunstone and discussions, especially in philosophy. You may not recognize him. I think this may be your second year with short hair. But Ben has been known to many of us for his striking long hair in the past. He is a graduate student working on a doctorate at Notre Dame. He's finished all of his coursework, and he's now in a parental sabbatical or something where they're sort of, he's moved back home to Spanish Fork while he's completing his dissertation. His dissertation is on friendship, or the concept of friendship in Aristotle's Ethics, and it's, you gave me something else to say, but I forgot it.
And its place in ethical life.
Its place. So friendship and its place in ethical life, and kind of through an Aristotelian thing view. So he's a PhD candidate, nearly completing that at Notre Dame, though living and working at the moment in Spanish Fork, Utah. So we're grateful to him. The two of them know each other as well, and I know it's just going to be an exciting exchange of ideas. So I turn the time over to Jim McLaughlin.
I will be changing glasses. I've reached that point in life when I really should get bifocals, but I don't know, trifocals. I have the part I can see without glasses, the part I can see with regular glasses, and the reading glasses. So, you know, as this happens, I hope I don't get confused. It's good to be here today at Sunstone. I really am pleased that Ben Huff will comment on the paper. I have to tell you that Ben got a copy of the paper last night, and so you know it's a brave thing that he's doing. And you know, I probably gave it to him last night. You know, I could say because there are other excuses I could get up, but you know, the real reason, of course, is I didn't want him to have it long enough to really get into it. Then he could have find all the flaws. But anyway, I'm really pleased to have Ben doing this, and I'm pleased to be here, have you here. If you came in late, there's a handout, and whether the handout makes any sense, well, I'll try and make sense of it. Last year I had a much sexier title for my talk, and you know, Mormonism is two ultimates just doesn't sound like something that, you know, I really appreciate your courage and coming here. Last year I had a paper called Whoring, Polygamy, or Just Friendship, How Mormons Might Think of Other Religions. You know, that was more of a Sunstone title, whereas, you know, the Mormonism and its two ultimates is kind of like, oh, gee. Okay. This is my work in philosophy is heavily influenced by a couple of things, and I just want to mention these, by, you know, what Dan talked about, by process theology. I spent a year last year out in Claremont, California, at the Center for Process Studies at Claremont School of Theology, and there I gave a talk on Mormonism and process philosophy and process theology, and that's actually the little handout that I gave you is from that lecture. I've been working on this long paper on, it's called Fragments for a Process Theology of Mormonism, and part of what I'm going to say today is from that paper. I'm not going to read the paper because that would bore you to tears, and so I'm going to try and talk about this in a way that would be at least somewhat interesting. So, what I'm going to do, and Dan says I have to talk into this, so excuse me for playing Tom Jones for a second here. I'm not going to sing, though. Here's where we'll start out. I'm going to start out with something that's not in the paper I gave to Ben. It's from the paper last year. But usually when we think of other religions, at least Christian theologians who talk about this, say that there are basically three approaches that we take. We can be exclusivists. This is what I call whoring. That's that everybody else is wrong but us, and if you look at their religion, you're being unfaithful. Okay, there's good things and bad things about this. We won't get into it too much, but this is that, you know, one's true, one religion is true as ours. The other one I teach in the South. I meet a lot of exclusivists, by the way. every once in a while on final exams, somebody tries to save me. You know, Dr. McLaughlin, I've really enjoyed this class. I hope someday you find Christ. You know? Okay. Anyway. You'd have to live there to understand it. You know, it's nice. It's actually sweet. You know, they're telling you you're going to hell, but they don't want you to go to hell. They want you to, you know. So, anyway, it's okay. Okay, well, inclusivists, that's kind of like polygamy in a way. It's the belief that all religions are really just versions of my own. Okay, and this is a position I think that most of us Mormons take, that there's good in everything, there's just ultimate truth in us. Okay, so you know, you look at Buddhism, and you can talk about the figure of the Bodhisattva as somebody who, you know, sacrifices himself towards other for the good of others, you know, through ultimate compassion. So that's all true. Okay, it's just they have to find Jesus. Okay, and the Book of Mormon. But anyway, so that's the inclusivist notion. The third notion that's become quite popular, and I lost the cap to this, so it'll dry up, is the pluralist notion. And there are various ways that people talk about that. One is the most popular one was put forward by the two people. If you've ever read Houston Smith's The Religions of Man, you kind of get a version of that. Houston Smith is one of the nicest people in the world. Okay, he's just a wonderful guy, and he talks about this. Another one is John Hick. He's probably the most famous for this position. Basically, the first type of pluralist position, which I don't think is really pluralism either. When you think of pluralism, you say, there's a lot of religions in the world. We're not going to solve this problem, okay, at least not philosophically. And so, you know, and they're teaching different things. Actually, though, Houston Smith and John Hick take a position on pluralism that's more or less like this. You've all heard this before, too. Here's the mountains. Here's the mountain, and then here's the Christian path up the mountain. Here's the Hindu path up the mountain. Here's the Buddhist path up the mountain. Here's the Muslim path up the mountain. The Jewish path is back here. You know, the Mormon path is wherever. And but the idea here is they're all paths to the same unspeakable reality. Now, you know, where this leads into my paper is that I don't think Smith and Hick are real pluralists because they tell you, you know, that even though they say they're not going to tell you what this unspeakable reality is, they do. And I think this is unavoidable for human beings. Okay? I mean, we just have to do this. I mean, you know, it's kind of like if you ever read Wuthering Heights, I mean, Heathcliff loves Kathy with a passion, an incredible passion. Nobody will do but Kathy. Kathy is the most wonderful, the essence of the world. I think this is what, you know, and, you know, you might be able to sit back and say, well, yeah, there are other wonderful people in the world, but they're wonderful because they're like Kathy. Okay? And this is what I think we unfailingly do. I mean, you know, we all end up, I think, back in inclusivism thinking, yeah, what's true in Buddhism is what's like Mormonism. I can appreciate the other stuff, but they're just not right about that. Okay, But anyway, so what Hicken, the reason I'm not comfortable with Smith's and Hicks' position is they end up saying, well, okay, what this is here, and it's the real, and everybody likes to say things in German, it makes it more impressive, the real an sich, which is in itself. And what they end up saying is this is ultimately impersonal. We have different ways of talking about it. We have the impersonal way, which is done by, say, one of the things about religion is you can always oversimplify. Remember, people always say Hindus have an impersonal ultimate. Yeah, they don't. Some do, some don't. Okay, it's like can't say Christians have a personal ultimate because then you have all these mystics with impersonal ones. But anyway, they say this impersonal ultimate, which would be like there are Hindus like the Hindu philosopher Shankara, who started the tradition called Advaita Vedanta, which says that two is not ultimately real. What's ultimately real is one. And the one is beyond all thinking and saying. Okay, and that's Nirguna Brahman. Brahman without manifestation. And that is ultimately impersonal. And that's what Hick and Smith end up saying. Now that's kind of interesting. And they say, well, all personal ways of talking about the ultimate reality, they end up saying, are mythological. Okay. Now, why do they don't think this is mythological, I'm not sure, because as you remember, we all end up coming down somewhere. But no, this is beyond that. It's beyond the myth. It's the impersonal, and that's what's ultimately real. Okay, the second way of talking about the ultimate is the way, one of the problems with this is supposed to be a pluralist position that takes in everybody, and yet if one of my Southern Baptist kids read Hick, he would, be like one of those old vampire movies, Dracula, where they put the cross up. And they wouldn't recognize themselves in this. They wouldn't see their belief in the ultimate here. Of course, they probably wouldn't believe in what I'm going to say either, but anyway. But the other way to look at it is that we have a personal ultimate, okay? So the impersonal ultimate would be being or the ground of being or whatever you want to call it. I'm going to cheat and just go cut to where I'm going to get to in my paper. I'm going to call it desire. Okay, we'll get into that. Or freedom. Gee, I don't write very well on this. And, of course, the personal ultimate would be God. Okay? Of course, there are other ways we could talk about those, too. But so there's two ultimates, one impersonal, one personal. For Hick, this is what's ultimately real. When you get into people like the process theologian John Cobb says, no. You've got to admit that Buddhists and Christians might even be talking about different truths. Okay? If you're going to really give them their due, that Buddhists and Christians might even be talking about different truths. Or you could go to, there's a more of a Hegelian position that's put forward by Raimundo Panikkar, which is, he's a really interesting guy because his mother was Hindu, his father was Catholic, so he was in serious need of trying to get this all together. And what Panikkar says is, no, it's both. Okay, you have both a personal and an impersonal ultimate. Religions both have different truths, and yet somehow they interlock, like languages. Languages can be translated one into the other, and yet, as any of you who know another language know, that's an infinite task. You never get done getting a good translation of something. That's why any great book, Dostoevsky's Brothers Karamazov, has to be retranslated every few years because you're always trying to get it. What is exactly the Russian like? And I think this is the same when we talk about religions. We end up thinking about them in ways that we constantly have to keep retranslating. I'll come back to this to the board in a minute, but actually now I want to get into my paper. I'm about halfway done, but okay. I want to start out talking about the idea that Mormonism has two ultimates, a personal and an impersonal one. Those of you who've read Orson Pratt already know this. Okay. It's in Orson Pratt. It's also in B.H. Roberts. I believe it's also in Joseph Smith, and that's the handout I gave you. I won't be talking too much about, but there are a lot of scriptures on there that I think talk about what I would say would be a personal ultimate and an impersonal ultimate. But we need to talk about what that means and why. I think for Mormons, this one, you know, even though we might have an impersonal ultimate, it's always going to be there, still, this is superior. You know, that happened one ultimate, be superior to another one. We'll talk about that. Okay. Let me start out with a quote from William Ernst Hocking. One of my goals in life is to publish a book on William Henry Chamberlain. Anybody ever hear of him, by the way? Yay! Okay. All Mormons should read William H. Chamberlain. William H. Chamberlain was the first Mormon to study philosophy. He has a heroic, Christ-like life. He studied with George Holmes. Well, I could tell his story. His story is just fascinating. He's a guy with no money who just goes on these kind of odysseys. Studies with George Holmes Howison at the University of California, and then with John Dewey at University of Chicago, and with Josiah Royce at Harvard. His spell about at the turn of the century. Gets a job at BYU. Gets caught in the higher criticism evolution controversy. Gets not fired, but he was the most popular professor on campus, and they just kind of canceled all his classes. Lives wandering around teaching part-time at the University of Utah, gets a job at BY College up in Logan, gets the flu and the epidemic of the 1920s, and on his deathbed, the church says he can have his old job back. But anyway, he's an interesting guy. He's always faithful to the church, even despite everything that happened. And David O. McKay once wrote, you know, that it was a tragedy that what happened to him did happen to him. But anyway, he's behind some of this, because some of this is kind of his position. Hocking was someone he knew at California and at Harvard. But Hocking describes the situation. And I think this is where I want to start my paper and start talking about these two ultimates. Now, with this quote, I want you to think about sitting in a room with somebody you love. Okay? Because that's what Hocking's describing. And what kind of way would we have to look at the world to get at what Hocking's saying here? I have sometimes sat looking at a comrade. Oh, by the way, this is from Hocking's book, The Meaning of God in Human Experience, which is a significant title. I have sometimes sat looking at a comrade, speculating on this mysterious isolation of self from self. Why are we made so that I gaze and see of thee only the wall and never thee? The wall of thee is but a movable part of the wall of my world, and I also am a wall to thee. We look out at one another from behind masks. How would it seem if my mind could but once be within thine, and we could meet and without barrier be with each other? And then it has fallen upon me like a shock. But I am in thy soul. These things around me are in my experience. They are thy own. When I touch them and move them, I change thee. When I look at them, I see what thou seest. When I listen, I hear what thou hearest. I am in the great room of thy soul, and I experience thy very experience. For where art thou? Not here, behind those eyes, within that head, in darkness, fraternizing with chemical processes. Of these, in my own case, I know nothing. For my existence is spent not behind my wall, but in front of it. I am there, where I have treasures. But there art thou also. This world in which I live is the world of thy soul. And being within that, I am within thee. I can imagine no contact more real and thrilling than this, that we should meet and share identity, not through ineffable inner depth alone, but through the foregrounds of common experience, and that thou shouldest be not behind that mask, but here, pressing with all thy consciousness upon me, containing me with these things of mine. This is reality, and having seen it thus, I can never again be frightened into monadism by reflections which have strayed from their guiding insight. Now, for Hocking, what he's talking about here is what process theologians, Hegel, and others have called internal relationship. we get into all the metaphysical niceties of this, but we're not going to. But basically, it's that in all relationships between beings, not just human beings, but here we're talking about human beings, we are modified by our relationship to the other. We are not just independent. Okay, not just independent. For example, one of the most famous examples of discussions of this was in Hegel's Phenomenology of Spirit, where he talks about the master-slave relationship. Where, you know, and this is a good way to, and Hegel does this because it's a good way to think about God. Okay, just as Hawking's passage is a good way to also think about God. He says, you know, what do we have in the master-slave? We've got a master that thinks he's the essential being in the universe. Okay? He's the center of everything. He is what he is. He is unchanging, he is perfect, and he has slaves who do the work for him. Now, there's an incredible irony here, because the master's only a master because he's got slaves. Okay? Master takes his, is, you know, for all his bellicose talk, all his egoism, he is changed by his relationship to his slaves. Because the slaves, after all, do all the work. Marx noticed this. You know, Marx read Hegel and loved this part. But he is changed. He is master because he has slaves. Just as the slave is a slave because he is forced to bend the will of the master. If you've ever seen the, you know, that great movie about the Civil War, Glory, made in 1989, there's a wonderful scene between Denzel Washington, a black soldier, and Broderick. I can't remember his first. Matthew Broderick, who plays Robert Shaw, the Union white colonel. And Washington says at one point, "Slavery has made us all dirty. White man, black man, everybody." Okay, it's because they're internally related. Nobody is untouched by this. Okay, they're related to each other. They are what they are. You know, the master, the slave, because of their relation. And the relation in this case distorts them. It's not like the relationship between Hawking and his wife. In the same sense, Hegel says we can think of God in this way. You know, in this traditional, let's see if I can put another thing up on the board here. Let's talk about power for a second. Let's put it on a continuum from one, or monism over here, to, let's say, a dualism over here. This is the way you can talk about problems like evil and suffering as well. But if we say that God has all power, we're saying things awfully like, at least Hegel thought, like God is like the master in the master-slave relationship. He's the absolutely essential being, and nobody else affects God in any way. You could say this also about the an sich. Because nothing that goes on in the world changes it. This is the problem. Brahman, as described by Shankara in Advaita Vedanta, says, you know, everything that we do is ultimately an illusion. Nothing of it ultimately matters. This is one way to solve the problem of evil, because there isn't any. Okay? But in this world, where if you take both of them, you know, both in this case, both personal God and impersonal God, seen as the one source of all power, turns the world into kind of unessential. But as Hegel pointed out with the master and the slave, in order, you know, just like mothers are only mothers because they have children, gods are only gods because they have beings that worship them. And so there is a internal relationship between gods and human beings. I think this is true also, even if we talk about an impersonal ultimate, Hegel talks about this too and says, you know, being can only be being because there are beings. Okay, we can't, you know, have any of you seen being lately? I mean, people talk about this. C.S. Lewis used to say, I used to try and imagine God as not having any kind of characteristics, and what I'd always end up thinking about is a great mass of gray tapioca. Okay? And that brings me to kind of the second part of this. I'm going to try and speed through this, but one of my other favorite philosophers, Nikolai Berdyaev, he's a Russian, was a follower of Dostoevsky, an existentialist, did most of his writings in the 20s and 30s as a immigré after the revolution. But he borrows from a German mystic named Jakob Berma. And what's interesting about Berma, I'm going to put these people here. Now, here we have one reality, we have many realities, actually Berdyaev and Schelling and so Hegel, these people are trying to bring them both together. People often talk about mysticism as talking about arriving at one absolute, impersonal, ultimate that's changeless, that's beyond time, that's beyond space, that's beyond anything. And those are people who have never read Jakob Berma, who is one of the most important of the German mystics. Because Berma wants to say, no, what mysticism really is doing is coming into an experience that brings the one and the many together. And he starts, and the way Berdyaev interprets this, through Berma's notion of, here's another name for the impersonal ultimate, the ungrund, the groundless. That we start out with an experience of chaotic desire, of groundlessness. Okay, and but that in itself, this ultimate, which you can also he also calls freedom. He calls it no thing. But in that, we don't have anything. This is not something to end up at. This is not something to worship. You have unity, you have oneness, but you don't have anything all that spectacular. God comes out of this desire into a kind of attempt to relate to other beings, and other beings come into existence through this creation of relation. So we move from chaotic disorder to order, at least somewhat ordered community of God and other beings. Okay, I'm paraphrasing this a lot, but I think the way to think about this is, have you all seen Groundhog's Day with Bill Murray? Okay, there's a wonderful Slavic theologian, philosopher Slavoj Žižek talks about this. This is the way to think about it. Bill Murray, okay, gets stuck in the cycle of desire on Groundhog's Day. He repeats the same day over and over and over again. This is timelessness. It's eternality. But it doesn't get anywhere. It doesn't go anyplace. It just cycles. What happens with Murray, the way he's able to break out of that, and this is kind of an indication, if you want to read Jakob Berma, this is the one-cent tour of it, is he goes to a kind of direction. And direction is he finally actually falls in love with somebody. Not just his own desire for her, the woman played by Andy McDowell in the film. He loves her. He sees her as another. He is affected by her, not just physically, not just for his own kind of egotistical desires. And that way he enters into, and also everybody in the town. He falls in love with them too. And he enters into a direction, and time begins again. And what you get in Berdyaev, and in Hegel, and in Whitehead, is the idea that time is, in a way, superior to eternity, if we think of eternity as just this cycle of endless going nowhere. Berdyaev talks about how what we move to out of the impersonal ultimate of desire and freedom to a personal ultimate of God and community, of what Berdyaev will call the relationship of the divine and the human. Okay. Now, if you read, it's my contention that if you read passages in the Doctrine and Covenants like section 88, we get a notion of internal relationships, that Christ becomes Christ because he's related most fully to all things. In 2 Nephi chapter 2, you've got a description, I think, fairly clearly, of something like what Berma and Schelling and Berdyaev are talking about, of coming out of a conscious unity. This is another way to think about this. The Romantics talked about it as a circuitous journey. The Wizard of Oz has Dorothy in Kansas. She's there at home with all her family, but she's really, you know, not happy because, you know, you have unity, but she doesn't have a self yet. Okay, so you come out of that kind of dead unity, okay, because unity in itself is nothing all that wonderful yet. And the tornado comes along, if you want it, from the Wizard of Oz, and she goes to Oz, and she's alienated. She's not like anybody else. She's kind of stuck in herself, but she starts to get friends, and she develops. Or if you want another film version of this, 2001, the apes are all unified. together in their fear and in their desire for food. Then one, the monolith appears, and they play the music from Richard Strauss, the folk Zarathustra, and he figures out, hey, it's a bone. He throws it in the air. It turns into a spaceship. But everybody's alienated again. So there's a fall into individuality, which is the second step. But what God really wants to pull us to is something beyond all three of those steps. You read Rime of the Ancient Mariner follows this same course. He wants us to get to a higher level, a higher unity, a unity that is chosen. And this unity is indicated or is imaged often by marriage. Marriage is where the two, the plurality, become one and remain two. Now, the way Mormons talk about the Christian concept of the Trinity has always been the many become one in will but remain many. Go back to Heathcliff and Kathy in Wuthering Heights. At the end of the novel, finally, Heathcliff overcomes his egotistical desire and is able to die and become one with Kathy. And he's buried even next to Linton, the person he hates most in the world. Okay? But it's a willed unity. So to end this and to give Ben some time to talk and then to have some time for discussion, what I think Mormonism and these types of views have is such a strength is that we can talk about both an impersonal and a personal ultimate. Being able to talk about a personal ultimate would make dialogue with Eastern religions much easier. Being able to talk about a personal ultimate, of course, makes dialogue with Western religions much easier. Okay. Another advantage of having both an impersonal and personal ultimate, I think for Mormons this would have to be agency, is that God does not possess all power. Human beings, dogs, cats, everything possesses some power too. And because of that, God can love. And so can we. If you think about it, I brought this up yesterday in a presentation, but if any of you have had a teddy bear at some time in your life, there's a certain time when that teddy bear becomes unsatisfactory. This is what's wrong with a master-slave relationship. Because as you're talking to yourself with the teddy bear, and the teddy bear is describing to you how wonderful you are, okay, this is why pornography and sex dolls don't work either, you realize that you are just talking to yourself. Whereas what God wanted, as Jacob Verma once said, God didn't want serfs, he wanted children. And if you're going to have children, you're going to have people who can say no. Really say no. Really say, I don't love you. Because part of the thrill of being told that you're loved is it's given to you freely. And so what we have in, I think, Mormonism is a kind of, I guess we could call it divine and human dialectic, okay, in which God is God because God is the most human. God is the most related to others. God understands what internal relationship and love are more perfectly than anyone else. And that's about all I have to say. Thank you.
Going to be interesting because indeed what you said was significantly different from what was in your paper, but I think I have some questions at least. There's a couple of things I'd like to amplify on and then a couple of things I'd like to press for a little more on. I guess the main theme, this idea that God is a personal ultimate, I'm really excited about. I love that. And I really like how you've drawn in this idea from process thought, that what it is to be God is to be in a certain kind of relationship with other beings, with the cosmos, and especially with us, his children, right? There's some really interesting scriptures I think support this. You mentioned a couple. I'd like to read a couple of verses from a couple of spots that I think express this, how God is God because of a certain kind of relationship he takes up with us. And it's not just a relationship of being, whatever that is. I'm not sure how interesting a contrast it is between being and doing. I'm not sure I buy the contrast, but I think sometimes people believe in the contrast. And if I was going to pick one, I would say doing. It's a relationship of doing and feeling. God does and feels certain things toward us and toward, once you get into talking about a cosmos in which there are many gods, he has a certain kind of relationship with other gods as well. Which is very important, or at least we can say a little more specifically, since we hear about them, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit do and feel things together, and that's what makes them one God. And I'd like to look at a couple of scriptures here. I mean, you all know Moses 1:39, right? For behold, this is my work and my glory, to bring to pass the immortality and eternal life of man. I think it's very plausible to read this as a statement about fundamentally what it is for God, in his eyes, what it means to him to be God. It's not absolutely clear that that is what he means, but I think that's a very reasonable way to read it, that what it is to be God for him is to have this project, to take up this project, and really work on bringing his children to eternal life. I'd like to look at some stuff that Christ says about himself when he's announcing himself to the Nephites. It's reminiscent. I mean, there's throughout the scriptures we talk about, the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, the God who covenanted with Abraham and gave the Israelites Canaan. And then Christ, when he's coming to the Nephites, I think this is a really interesting time because this is... Here we're hearing from Christ, and he's very recently, in Paul's interpretation anyway, become fully like his Father, taken on the fullness of power and glory that he was foreordained to. And, of course, he had, there was something really special about him all along. But I think it's interesting to hear from him at this time how he describes himself. He announces himself in 13:9, starting with verse 15. Behold, I am Jesus Christ, the Son of God. I created the heavens and the earth and all things that in them are. I was with the Father from the beginning. I am in the Father and the Father in me, and in me hath the Father glorified his name. I came unto my own and my own received me not, and the scriptures concerning my coming are fulfilled. And as many as received me, to them have I given to become the sons of God. And even so will I to as many as shall believe on my name. For behold, by me redemption cometh, and in me is the law of Moses fulfilled. This is what it is for Christ to be Christ, right? He is and does these things, and a lot of them are fairly concrete. I think this is a really exciting thing about... I think it's really exciting that we're prepared to understand God, I think, in a much more concrete and personal way, more personally than most of the Western religions, right? Let's see. So, but I want to say a little more, though, about deification. Let's see. Okay, I better wrap up pretty quick here. I think it's exciting to think about becoming gods in the LDS view as a matter of taking up this project in the kind of full way that Christ did, and obviously none of us are prepared to really do right away, right? We have we have a lot of ways we need to get our act together before we can take up that project, before we can feel that way consistently and deeply in the way that they do, before we can look out at the earth and weep the way God sees Enoch weeping when he sees the wickedness, and yet rejoice when we sort of direct our gaze to a different part of the world or a different part of history and think about the redemption, and rejoice in the kind of deep way that that our Father does, I think, in seeing that plan unfold and in seeing its effects. I want to press you a little bit on this impersonal ultimate. It's interesting because I think for a lot of other traditions, the impersonal ultimate for some of them, they want to say it is God, right? Where it sounds like you're saying that the impersonal ultimate for us is something that allows creatures to have kind of an authentic relationship with God. And I guess it's something that, that God participates in as well. I mean, he has it too. But, okay. Let's see. Do I still have something to say about the impersonal ultimate? Okay. Maybe not. That's really exciting. I mean, I guess a lot of Mormons, like I've heard Stephen Robinson talking about a certain view of the divine nature, which is something that gods with a little g can in some way share with God with a big G. That's how he casts it. There's still this very distinct, there's gods with little g and there's God with a big G, right? And I guess I have a lot of doubts about that, and I think that the reality of God, when it comes down to it, I don't think we have to share in some kind of abstract essence in order to join with God in Godhood. Seems to me it's enough to join in the project of the project that makes him God, of loving perfectly all of creation and especially imperfect spirit beings like us, who he can lead on to greater things. And for us to take up that project too, I think it's a very concrete project. But being involved in that project is what it is to be God, and not some kind of abstract essence. But so I guess I'm really excited about this different impersonal ultimate, and maybe that's all I'll say about it. Thanks a lot.
I want to take just a minute or two and respond to Ben. Ben understands me better than I understand myself, which is good. He made it, I think, more clear. Let's say something about the impersonal ultimate. Let's see. If you read 2 Nephi chapter 2, I'm going to go down here and get a copy. Nephi chapter 2. You know, it talks about creation from chaos. This is actually in Creation from Chaos, Dipolarism, Positive Fall, Possibility of Evil on this process thought in Mormonism. But the idea here is, if we take a look at just verse 11 and 12, it says, "It must needs be that there is an opposition in all things. If not so, my firstborn in the wilderness, righteousness could not be brought to pass, neither wickedness, neither holiness nor misery, nor good nor bad. Wherefore, all things must need be a compound in one." Let me emphasize that. "Wherefore, it should be one body." and remain as dead, having no life, neither death, nor corruption, nor incorruption, happiness, nor misery, neither sense, nor sensibility. Now, that for me is a description of the impersonal ultimate, in a way. If we talk about, it would be, Freud was heavily influenced by the Romantics. You know, he never admits this. He says he's discovered this scientifically, like all good positivists. But if you think of the Freudian id, as this just sheer desire that unless it encounters the ego, unless it encounters the superego, unless it encounters other and has to repress, Freud never admits this. Viktor Frankl does, and Viktor Frankl, I think, does a better job in this than Freud. But you never become a person. You remain just this bundle of desires. Okay, and in a way, I think that's what what Lehi is describing here is it would remain as a unity, as one, as nothing, as no thing, as that chaos out of which God eventually will create the world. But then we get the purpose of this in, down there in the what should be the Mormon mantra. Verse 25, Adam fell that men might be and men are that they might have joy. You only get persons with this opposition. Opposition between human beings and God, opposition between just, we can talk about good and evil, we can talk about a lot of things. But somehow what Lehi is saying, and this is what, when we're talking about a personal ultimate, that it is superior to be in this position. Dorothy is better off in Oz than she was in Kansas. Now, if she stays in Oz forever, she's alienated and she's not at home. But the Kansas she gets to at the end is a better place than the Kansas she left. Okay, just as, for us as Mormons, the pre-existence was nice, so was the Garden of Eden, but it wasn't all that great. And because love did not exist, really. And what the project is creating gods, is creating this love. Now, Berdyaev at one point says, anything that insults man is also an insult to God. And I believe that is true. I think that, that's what Joseph Smith talks about in the King Follett Discourse. Because if we place God totally beyond whatever human beings can attain, whatever creatures can attain, I think that's an insult to God. God's project is to bring about the immortality and eternal life of man, is to bring about other beings that are worthy of love, and that happens in equality, not in hierarchy. And that's where I think this project should go. Anyway, let's have some questions. Yeah.
I wonder if you could help me with the history and the situation of the King Follett Discourse. Was it in Nauvoo?
Yeah.
And what were the circumstances? I cannot imagine those pioneers riding their horses and Joseph Smith.
Yeah, it was in Nauvoo. It's a few months before he dies. It's on the occasion of, and I'm not a historian. If I know this is Sunstone, there are historians out there, so, if you can correct me, go ahead and do it. But it's on the occasion of the death of King Follett. This is what he says in the first line, he was down in a well. King Follett? Yeah, I guess they do. Historians, where are you? He was a guy, he was working in a well, and a stone fell on him and killed him. And so he was speaking at his funeral, and what he's doing in the funeral is, what you do at funerals, he's explaining the plan of salvation, and he's doing it in ways that people hadn't really heard of before. I think it's a wonderful funeral speech because it means that King Follett has he's a good guy. He's got quite a destiny ahead of him.
But he doesn't talk about soul. He doesn't talk about resurrection. He talks about the nature of God.
Yeah, but he talks about what it is. There's a wonderful passage here. Let me just read this. From, if I can, let's see. Divine Community. Okay. God himself once, no, that's not it. I thought I had it here. Maybe I don't. There's a wonderful passage in the King Follett Discourse where he says that God, finding himself among beings likes himself, desired that they should all be like him. That they should have the same knowledge and advancement as he does. And that's about the resurrection. That's about, eternal life. That's about, what the possibilities are for King Follett. Yeah.
A question about this personal God, or the personal ultimate.
Yeah.
Obviously, Mormonism has evolved as a theistic movement.
Mm-hmm.
So when we worship God, we worship a person. We are talking to a person who can
right.
come back to us, we are trying to emulate
yeah.
personal. I guess what I'm wondering is, what would it look like to have a Mormonism that worshipped an impersonal ultimate? Perhaps
yeah.
Buddhism is an analog here, but
yeah. Okay. Let's just use Buddhism. Or you can use Orson Pratt, because he has this generic idea of God. This is kind of an impersonal bunch of like a job description. But it's not exactly, Pratt isn't exactly like what I'm talking about, but it's sort of like it. But I don't know. Here I'm with Virjaya. I think Mormons, you don't worship the impersonal ultimate. It's like, you only can worship a person. But in this, worship, God is worship because God's the most loving, the most personal, the most human. In a sense, I think Mormons, even though we say we don't, I think we venerate our ancestors like in a lot of primal religions, because we recognize a kind of divinity in them as well. And so what's worshipped is as much as just God is the community of gods that we hope to be in. Section 130, verses 1 and 2, is one of the great sections, where verse 1 talks about, at that time we'll come to see Christ, we'll see that he's a man like us. And he says, the same sociality that exists among us here will exist among us there, only in a perfected form that we don't know now. I guess what he's saying is, we'll get beyond hate. We'll get beyond jealousy. We'll get beyond thinking. Remember when they used to have the law of adoption back in the 19th century? Is your kingdom bigger than mine? Which is kind of the wrong way to think about it. I wrote a book called The Desire to Be God, and that's based on the idea that way we think about God is power, and the way we try to emulate power. Think of the way the monarchs in Christian tradition tried to see themselves as like God, and the way we interpreted God in terms of monarchy and hierarchy. That is exactly the wrong way to go about it. That's the way you become like Milton's Lucifer, who wants to be God, wants to control everything. Okay. The community is that Joseph Smith, I think, is talking about, and what the Lord describes to us in the Doctrine and Covenants is much different. Yeah.
Would you also comment on this concept in the world of brain synapses?
Oh, you're way off past me now. Okay. The world of brain synapses. Okay. Yeah, come up and speak into the mic. This sounds like a complicated question. They want to get you on the tape. Okay.
Maybe not. In the world of brain synapses, the brain can either try to bring a holistic interpretation, like personal ultimates or impersonal ultimates, to give meaning to experience and to bring chaotic life experiences into some meaning. Okay, or it can divide them up and break them down to very small common denominators and learn by that experience. Is there a chance that what we're seeing here with personal ultimates or impersonal ultimates is just a little trick that the brain pulls on us trying to give meaning, and that really, technically speaking, it may give happiness to us to, if you're a Mormon, we'd say, well, let's have some personal ultimates. But if you're a Buddhist, you'd say, I don't need to be Dorothy with the Tin Man and the City of Oz and the monkeys and so on. I can be concentrating on myself and look inward and come to as much meaning as you Mormons do, trying to find all these angels and spirits and intelligences and interrelating with ancestors and so on. Is it a trick that our brain has pulled on us, and that maybe dividing things up and looking at discrete elements and diversity and all these breaking things down to the lowest common denominator, the scientific view, is really a better way to go through life? Even though it may not be as fun, it may be a better way to go through life.
No. Okay, sorry. I'm going to let Ben respond. okay. Let me... great French philosopher Henri Bergson once pointed out that we live in a world of images. Okay, the brain is an image. Because if you think about it, the brain's an idea as much as anything is. We observe what we observe, and we try and make sense of it through language. And so you're right, we have this constant kind of retranslation of our experience into language. Just as when we talk about Buddhism as being another religion, we try and translate it into terms that we would understand. My answer to your question is kind of like William James's, but I'm going to appeal to Woody Allen in Annie Hall. One part of the film, Alvy goes into the doctor, and he's depressed, and people ask him, well, why are you depressed? And he says, well, the universe is expanding. And the doctor looks at him, so? He says, well, the universe is all there is. And he says, well... And if it keeps expanding, there's not going to be anything. And there's, you know, it's a cold, empty, meaningless place. The doctor says, well, gee, that won't happen for billions of years, and we've got to have all the fun we have now. Can have now. And this does absolutely no good for the kid. You know, because he wants meaning. And what William James says about this is I don't think that there is unequivocal proof one way or the other whether there, you know, we're in a universe of just... empty matter that's expanding and it's going to be cold and lonely and empty forever afterwards, or a universe in which there are some kind of ultimates, personal or impersonal. I like to believe in the latter because I think there's some evidence for it, although that's not the main reason. But because I like to believe that love wins out over meaninglessness ultimately, and you know that's. Like you say, this is going to be based on different experiences of the world. As far as Buddhism goes, though, I do have to respond to that. We always, when we look at world religions, we do a kind of simplification always of what goes on in them. Like when we talk about Mormonism, we oversimplify. When we talk about Catholicism, when I talk about Southern Baptist. But Buddhism... compassion is an important thing. And actually, I think Mormons would be really profitably served by looking at Mahayana Buddhism, northern Buddhism that's mainly practiced in China and Japan, especially the varieties that talk about bodhisattvas. Because it seems to me that the Buddhist bodhisattva, the being of compassion who will not enter nirvana until everybody else does, every other creature in the world, who creates a pure land, where we can all go and work on the nirvana thing. It's as much a turning outward as it is a turning inward. It seems to me that in a lot of ways the Buddhist notion of the bodhisattva is a lot more close to the Mormon idea of God than the traditional Christian one that Robinson talks about. Okay, well, anyway, I'm going to end with that. You want to respond?
Maybe.
You more, and I don't know enough about brain synapses to say anything.
I do think that in a lot of ways these ideas of personal ultimate and impersonal ultimate can kind of there is a danger that they can float off into never land of abstraction. I think that they can be become kind of abstractions or oversimplifications, which is often what I think abstractions are, oversimplifications that we hide behind and by which we avoid a lot of real life. So as far as that goes, I think if there was something like that in behind your question, I think there's some truth to it. On the other hand, I think they are very useful ideas with to reflect on and to use to kind of prod the way that we do approach the world and in which I think we're often prone to fall into bad habits. I think, but I think in the end, living our lives is what we should be doing. And when we live our lives sincerely, we will find that God's way of life resonates with our hearts in ways that no other way of life does. So maybe that's my answer to pushing for concreteness, is living by our hearts, which sounds very different maybe from the scientific approach to the world. I don't know. But
We have time for maybe one more question, and then we can... Yes, you want to come up?
I wonder if a way to resolve some of this in a personal way doesn't have to do with this notion. Often, if we think in the power structure you're talking about, we sort of rebel against the notion that what God wants for us to do is obey Him. And yet, and this is a big if your concept of God is someone really worth worshiping at a very deep level, that is the ultimate of goodness and beauty and truth and wholeness and holiness, then your concept of what God is what your own deepest values and yearnings for are. And that being true to God is being true to one's deepest self. That, in fact, obeying what He is hoping for us, our ultimate being and joy and fulfillment, being true to that or obeying that is really being truly independent, because we're being true to our deepest self. And it's that love and worship that gives you the power to change habits and things that violate your own deepest values, and to come to be true not only to God but to oneself. And so they come together in, I think, a very practical and powerful way. Would you agree with that? Or
Yes. I think you're right. Obedience needs to be interpreted in terms of God desires that you come to be like God. And to become to be like God is to become to be yourself. And if we look at it in terms of what Hawking says in that first quote I read, Hawking is Hawking because he's related to his wife Dorothy. Okay, he says he lives outside in her world. You know, his conscious life is not in just the synapses. Although, you know, we've got to talk about what that means, because that has, you know, problem with idealists, they keep forgetting those. Okay, but he does live outside in the world of her experience as well as his experience, and that's a created world that's created by a community. So I would agree with that. Yeah. Let's see. I guess we're pretty well out of time. Did you want to say something?
No.
But I want to thank you all for coming and suffering through this. This is also, you know, the solution to the problem of suffering is that egoism just doesn't work. That's what we can learn from Buddhism too. Okay. On this, yeah, there's a few articles that I've written. I've got one on William H. Chamberlain that's